When I was an intern at our congregation in Concord, Massachusetts, I got to know their sexton, Doug Baker. Great guy, fabulous painter. And we shared a love of incense. So he'd often sneak up to my office door and light some incense in the hallway and then run away. But watch around the corner to see how long it took me to notice. And then he'd always ask me if I could recognize the fragrance. Apparently this was a medieval Japanese game, recognizing the incense smell. They even would have parties where they would create a journey from Kyoto to Nagasaki, each stage of the journey being represented by a different incense smell. Anyway, Doug lived a very simple life. A very simple life. His home was the opposite of my office. It was clean, almost Spartan. This was a man who clearly didn't use material things as his measuring stick, wasn't caught up in conspicuous consumption. But one day I noticed what seemed to me to be a contradiction. He had a Burmese temple bell, for instance, and I don't remember exactly, but I think it cost somewhere around $1,000. He had a Buddha statue, beautiful, elegant, which cost, let's say, more than the gong. And that Japanese woodblock print on the wall, and I could go on and on, but the point is that while he may not have put a lot of stock in stuff, he sure did sink a lot of money into it. It clearly was important to him. And when I asked him about this, he said that his goal in life was to live a really simple life, surrounded by really good stuff. Stuff. Stuff is so important in our society. Stuff, stuff, and more stuff. I talked once with a German friend about what I had always heard, that English is such a difficult language to learn because our rules are so chaotic and so inconsistently enforced. Not at all like German, where if you say something just the wrong way, it's unintelligible. Well, Christoph laughed when I said this and said, actually, English is really easy. All you have to learn is the word stuff. And then you're basically fine. Back in 97, which my kids call the olden days, the inimitable George Carlin created a monologue about stuff that has become justly famous. Stuff is important, he said. You gotta take care of your stuff. You gotta have a place for your stuff. Everybody's gotta have a place for their stuff. That's what life is all about, trying to find a place for your stuff. That's all your house is, a place to keep your stuff. If you didn't have so much stuff, you wouldn't need a house. A house is just a pile of stuff with a cover on it. That's just a taste of the monologue. The whole thing is great, and if you've never heard it or don't really remember it, check it out. It's worth it. But I would disagree with Carlin on one thing. Life's not about finding a place for your stuff. It's also about getting more stuff and better stuff. Also in 97, perhaps not coincidentally, a term came into popular consciousness that had apparently been created originally in 1954, but came to prominence. It was a term that described America's sickness, the sickness that ravaged our country. The term was affluenza, the sickness that's brought about by our nation's relative affluence, the sickness of not just wanting, but feeling that we need more stuff. The venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist monk, peace activist, and poet, has said that our country reminds him of the Buddhist figure, the Hungry Ghost. The Hungry Ghost is a mythological figure with a huge belly and a pinhole for a mouth. So its hunger was insatiable. It could never get enough. And that, he said, is the United States. So it's not so surprising that we hear so much about the importance of simplifying our lives as the answer to our problems. Other places at other times have said the same thing, of course, but never before in the history of humankind have there been so many magazines and books devoted to not having stuff. Magazines and books that, of course, we buy, put on our coffee table, or on our shelves. We might say that getting rid of clutter is important, both the external and the internal clutter. We might say that that's the secret, or at least a part of the secret, to living a happy life. But how many of us do it? How many of us can do it? How many of us actually want to do it? To give up the things that we have taken so much time and effort and pride in gathering, those things that matter to us and in some ways make us who we are, or at least describe who we are. Last week, I finally followed my Franciscan leanings and culled my office library. I gave over 250 books to the church library in Summit House and the racial justice library in the church parlor. And you know what? I still have a lot of books in my office, books that I couldn't get rid of. And then I have more books at home. And that's not even counting my comic book collection, which is a separate thing, a room unto itself. I said in the bulletin this month that if I could have just one book with me when I was shipwrecked on a deserted island, it'd be Stephen Mitchell's translation of the Tao Te Ching. But there's a reason I don't take a lot of ocean voyages. Because I don't want to run the risk of having only one book for the rest of my life. I know that it's important to simplify my life. At least that's what I've heard and read and watched documentaries about. And yet, I don't. Not really. I love my iPhone and this iPad because of how much stuff I can get into it and then carry around with me. I love that I can do so much stuff and often do it at the same time. I was watching a TED talk about simplifying my life the other night, and while I was answering an email, posting on Facebook, and writing this sermon. Not really, but it could have happened. Both Arthur and I, and maybe some of you, receive in our inbox daily a meditation from the Franciscan priest, Father Richard Rohr. Lately, they've been drawing from his book, Falling Upward, a Spirituality for the Two Halves of Life. He's not the first person to make this observation. He credits Carl Jung. But the idea in this book is that there are two halves to human life. The first half is about getting, gaining, getting a sense of identity, gaining skills, gaining mastery of the world, getting relationships, getting the material things in life that provide safety and comfort, gaining, well, let's just leave it at that and say that the first half of life is about gaining. The second half of life is about letting go. Letting go of the need to always be doing something. Letting go of relationships as people we have loved get sick and die. Letting go of physical abilities that we'd relied on and maybe taken pride in. Letting go of some of those things, maybe all of those things, that had given us our sense of identity in that first half of life. I see this in a way in my role as a dad. In the first half of my relationship with them, we were a unit. Me, my mom, and the kids. Like their mom and the kids. And of course, from my own perspective, it revolved around me. I was the kid's dad. That was identity. And they were my kids. But we're now quickly, and amazingly quickly at that, too quickly for me, entering into the second half of that relationship, in which I learn, to paraphrase Khalil Gibran, that my children are not my children, that they are the children of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but belong not to you. This second half of this relationship with my kids is all about letting them go, letting them become the center of their own circles. And that's how it is about everything in the second half of life. It's about letting it go. Rohr says, and this is where this all ties into this morning's sermon, that each half of life has a different spiritual focus, has different spiritual needs. And the trying to apply the one to the other will only lead to frustration. Now, it's important to note that these two halves are not necessarily chronological. Think of all the middle-aged men who are trying really hard to be adolescents. They're stuck in that first half. And Rohr says that he knew an 11-year-old dying on the cancer ward who was well into the second half. So these two halves do not necessarily fall neatly onto a timeline, yet they often do. And perhaps this is what the well-known middle-aged crisis is all about, recognizing that transition from one to the other and fighting it with all that we have. I think it's worth pointing out, too, that our country can be described as being in the first half of life. The United States is really pretty young, as countries go. England, which one of my kids said just voted to the EU and become a country. England first became a unified state in the 10th century. England had already been a country three times longer than the United States has been a country when the United States became a country. Put another and maybe clearer way, the U.S. has been a country for 240 years. England has been a country for about 1,100. We're kids. And so it makes sense that our nation is the way it is, all about gaining, getting, establishing itself. And if that's the national zeitgeist, then it makes sense that the pressures would be on us to stay in that mode too. I'm wondering whether or not it's worth reframing this advice to simplify our lives, to saying that we need to clarify our lives, clarify where we are on our life's journey and what we need to do to make the most of it. Pure acquisition and overzealous focus on getting is not healthy. Neither is so much letting go that we really are giving up. A sense of balance is needed. Simplification through clarification. A little while ago, Arthur talked about that definition of well-being that the group he had worked with had come up with, 8 components that make up this thing called well-being, or maybe that we could say make up a happy and full life. Contribution, The feeling that your life makes a difference, has made a difference, is making a difference. That's important in either stage. But how we look at it, how we dance with it, will differ. In one, we are developing our abilities to make those contributions, actively making those contributions, defining ourselves by those contributions. In the other, we are assessing whether or not all that striving did make a contribution. And we're needing to find new ways to make contributions in this phase of our life. The next of those dimensions is identity, and you can see how this too would be different in, yet present in, both of these phases. Back again to that example of parenting. In the one, I am Theo and Les's dad. My identity changes as they become adults and not my kids. And I become, hopefully, maybe a grandfather, a new identity, but needing to let go of the old one. For this thing we call well-being, that group identified, we also need to grow, to develop, to expand. And you can see how this too would play out similarly yet differently. Autonomy is the fourth of the eight puzzle pieces. And again, there is a way in which this could manifest in the first half, however long that lasts for us, and the second, whenever we move to really embrace it. That sense of autonomy, being ourselves. The sense of security, too, is important in both, yet different in each. Connectedness changes over time. The quest for meaning in our lives and the things around us, and those experiences of joy and those things that bring us joy are likewise essential, whether we're in the phase of getting or letting go. And that is the takeaway that I hope you'll take away this morning. So often these two phases, these two halves, these two dimensions of life are presented to us and perceived by us as if one is positive and the other is negative. That time of getting, of doing, well, that's good. That time of letting go, bad. Getting all that we can out of life, that's the way life's supposed to be. Letting go of those things that once made us who we are, an unfortunate necessity. But the truth is, it's not such a dichotomy. It's more like the image found in Taoism of the yin-yang circle that has a curved and flowing boundary between the two halves rather than a straight and rigid line, the way we so often see things. And if you look at the symbol, you notice that each half, has a dot of the other half's color in it. Because there are a lot of opportunities in that first half of life to let go, and there is a lot to get in that second half of life. And so again, perhaps the lesson really isn't about simplifying, but clarifying. Clarifying where we are in life and how those eight dimensions of making a contribution, having a sense of identity, opportunities for growth, that experience of autonomy, feeling secure and safe, true connectedness, the seeking of meaning, experiences of joy. Learning how these eight components of well-being, of a well-lived life, are manifest in whichever stage we're in. And when we can see that clearly, we're no longer struggling against where we are. So there was a time when it was good that I was buying books and reading books and holding on to books so that I might share them with other people. No reason to fight that then. But there's a time to recognize that I don't need all of those books anymore and that I can give them away. No need to fight that either. What's so great about simplification? It helps us live our lives and not just exist, but live.